Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 Radio.
And now, for our more dreadful sacrifice.
Boy, all we gotta do is build an act, make you star. Dumbo the Great!
You're OG and I feel fine.
Slime-eating dogs and scum-sucking pigs,
you sons of a motherless goat.
I am big. It's the picture that got small.
I've never been alone with a man before, even with my dress on. With my dress off, it's most unusual.
What is it?
The stuff that dreams are made of.
Hey, what about Major Kong?
Hello, you are listening to Cambridge 105 Radio across the city and South Cambridgeshire. Many thanks to Ian for the past 2 hours, but now it's time for Bums on Seats, the cinema show where we decide the most popular film now on general release. My name is Alistair Ryder, and my reviewers in the studio are Rosie Applin.
Hello.
Laura Poole.
Hola.
Elena Franks.
Hi.
And Nidhi Gupta.
Hello.
What's on the show today? Well, over the next hour, we'll be looking at the last of this summer's superheroes with Ant-Man and the Wasp, while Hearts Beat Loud turns a midlife crisis into a pop music hit. Jason Statham is all that swims between a giant shark and a crowded beach in the Meg, and we go back to the school with Heathers as the classic 1988 satire is re-released this week. Plus, we have our second feature on the work of French filmmaker Agnès Varda, whose extraordinary cinema is now being showcased by the Gleaning Truths season of films at the Arts Picture House. But to begin the show, we're going to ponder the infinite.
Dr. Pym, I actually heard what happened to you. You opened up the quantum realm. That's when this crazy creepy ghost who, like, walks through walls and stuff. Stole your tech. And now she wants to take over the world or whatever.
The only chance you've got is both of you.
Ant-Man and the Wasp teaming up.
Follow my lead.
She seems more intense.
Get loose now.
No, no.
You go low, I'll go high.
I have wings. Why would I go low?
We're gonna die. I don't wanna die. We didn't die!
There's little disputing that after Black Panther and Infinity War, the blockbuster year belongs to Marvel. But their final film of 2018, Ant-Man and the Wasp, is a gentler affair, doubling down on the shrinking action of the first Ant-Man film to offer an inventively small-stakes superhero comedy. Set just before the cataclysmic events of the last Avengers movie, the film sees Paul Rudd return as the reluctant hero Scott Lang, now under house arrest after breaking the law to help Captain America. Meanwhile, Hope Van Dyne, played by Evangeline Lilly, has gained a super shrinking suit of her own. Now known as the Wasp, she kidnaps Scott, and together the two begin building a portal to the quantum realm, the sub-atomic world where Hope's mother, Janet Van Dyne, has been trapped for the past 30 years. Rosie, Ant-Man and the Wasp is a much lighter film than Infinity War, and if you take away the post-credit sequence, it doesn't directly tie in with the universe as a whole. Does this make it feel like a lighter effort, or is its relative independence from the rest of the Marvel universe something of a strength?
I think it stands alone as its own film, but it does link in with the rest of the Marvel universe and what's been going on. I think it's quite self-consciously an antidote to the intense darkness of Avengers Infinity War and what went on there. But it's a really fun film. It's very sort of cartoony, poppy. The soundtrack's great fun. A lot of bright colours. There's a bit of mild peril, but you never really feel, for the most part, anything's really going to kick off too badly. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was great fun. Ideal summer blockbuster, you know, lovely family film. But yeah, I thought, you know, it has got its connections to the rest of the Marvel Universe. Obviously, there's references to Captain America, and there is a reference to Infinity War, which I won't linger on for too long. But it works as a film of its own right, I think.
Okay, so Lava, I'm going to come to you now. As with Deadpool, I mean, superhero comedies, I mean, the second time around, the joke runs the risk of wearing thin. Does this stand up as a comedy, or is the joke sort of beginning to fall a bit flat?
I mean, there were some really funny moments in this film. I mean, there's a great scene regarding truth serum, and that's a great comedic moment where someone's getting injected and the baddies, it's not truth serum, the goodies, it is truth serum. That's funny. That is about it for me. I thought it didn't feel naturally funny for me. It felt too forced, and it just didn't... I don't know, they tried to have serious moments in it with... The lead bad girl, Hannah John, I think it's Karma or Kama, and she is going through something really serious, and then they'd suddenly try and have all these comedic moments at the same time as that, and it just felt like they couldn't decide if they were going the serious route or the too light-hearted route.
But that is just sort of the problem many people have with Marvel films as a whole, is the fact that even in Infinity War, where all of this stuff is happening... then a second later they'll all be cracking a joke, and it sort of undermines the seriousness.
It does, but it felt like that worked for me with Infinity War and the other films. But this one, it just felt lacking for me. It just didn't feel natural and it didn't feel real. And for me, I love Paul Rudd, and he was good as his character, but even he couldn't pull off the jokes like they were trying to do. The mix just wasn't quite right for me.
Okay, so I'm now going to go to Nidhi, because I know you've got a lot to say about the father-daughter relationships in the film. I mean, firstly, I mean, I've also got a sort of issue with the fact that the film's called Ant-Man and the Wasp, but I think that the Wasp feels like something of a secondary character and not really who the film is about. You see this as a film about father-daughter relationships to an extent.
Yeah, I mean, what I would say initially is that I really enjoyed it. I found it a lot of fun to watch, and kind of in the Marvel canon, I'm a big fan of the whole MCU, the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Kind of it's for me kind of the first Ant-Man and the second Ant-Man, along with the third the Taika Waititi Thor film. You know, actually, these superheroes can be funny. You don't have to all be serious and about saving the world all the time. A running theme through it is father and daughter relationships. There's 3/4 relationships. And this is a very kind of small thing, and it is a recurring theme. But all bar one, the daughters of all these grown-up women, have taken on the mantle of their father's livelihoods, their father's passions, obsessions, their enemies become their own enemies, and they don't seem to have developed themselves. Evangeline Lily's character, the Wasp, is very different to what she was in the first film. In the first film, she was very much had a difficult relationship with her father. That seems to have been resolved, but only by taking on his obsession. And I think that wasn't really fully acknowledged, that these are actually not entirely healthy relationships. And Paul Rudd's character, Ant-Man, is the only one who actually, when his daughter tries to take on his mantle, goes, no, actually, I'd be a really bad father if I did that. And that was, for me, like the one moment where it's like, OK, you get what's going on. And I'm not sure how much the writers and the filmmakers actually realised that was happening, and that was their attempt to, you know, acknowledge what was happening, or whether some of it was just, you know, something that came through without them realising it. But I actually really enjoyed it. I think it's a fun film. I think especially after Infinity War, which ended in such a bleak way, and I won't kind of go into that anymore either, I think it was just something, a bit of a kind of a nice kind of cleansing tonic, bit of a laugh, bit of fun, and actually I'm really looking forward to what they do with Ant-Man to bring into Infinity War Part 2, and then of course Captain America Civil War Part 2.
Okay, so Eleanor, it seems that at the box office, after Black Panther and Infinity War broke so many records, this one's sort of underwhelming. Do you think that superhero fatigue is beginning to kick in, or are these films still a bit of fun?
No, I think, and I don't think every film has to be like the biggest blockbuster in the world. I think there's, you know, particularly for people who kind of follow franchises or want something new, there's something to be said for a film that's a bit quieter, really. I think if this film doesn't do so well, one of the reasons it doesn't do so well might be, I think there's a bit of a disconnect between what you think it's about and what it's actually about. Because I was expecting, like, Ant-Man and the Wasp, and I got in there and there were all these characters, and I couldn't really work out who Ant-Man was and who the Wasp was. I was expecting a kind of 1970s comic book action hero and his sidekick. didn't turn out to be that.
So you're getting a superhero fatigue in a completely different way. You're like getting just worn out, just trying to map it out.
Yeah.
Well, actually, what I would say is I don't think... I mean, this film is not intended to be a billion-dollar film at all. And that's not the intentions of Marvel with this film. They've had $2 billion films. This is not at that level. I think also some note has to be made of just the amazing actors and the character, the kind of the side characters in terms of Michael Peña and like one of my personal favourites, Walton Goggins, who I think is totally underused. If you see him in Justified, and if you haven't seen Justified, highly recommend it. He's basically co-lead and he's a very nuanced character, which at the beginning comes across as quite one-dimensional but really develops. And I think here he's been given a one-dimensional character that he kind of, he really pulls off, but that's just the mark of how good an actor he is.
And also, I think this is a merchandise film. There's a lot of, you see the little plastic figures in the credits, and things get big, they get small. I think this is a collector's film. It's not a blockbuster, as you rightly pointed out.
I mean, it's kind of interesting you say that, because when I saw this sort of preview screening in London, and for the fans who were there, as a photo opportunity, it wasn't like, you know, cardboard cut out to the cast or whatever. It was like an oversized salt shaker. It was like a giant salt shaker. Like, look at how big this salt shaker is. It's been... Wow.
They do have a lot of fun with that in the film, though, and because I hadn't seen the first Ant-Man, and I genuinely thought that was all quite good fun, like all the big and small things happening. And I didn't realise they could do things like shrink things and make things bigger in the big apartment block building. I thought that was all quite good fun, to be honest.
I have to say, there's nothing in this film as good as in the first one where they make a giant Thomas the Tank Engine.
Except now, for the Pez dispenser. I did enjoy the Pez dispenser.
The Pez dispenser's pretty fun.
The big Hello Kitty Pez dispenser that they throw at some villains following along behind them. That was
just good. In general, what did you all think of the visuals? I mean, especially those who've seen the first one, is it still spectacular seeing things just, you know, shrink and grow?
I think it was done to more comic effect, I think, this time compared to the first time. And actually, I don't know whether you found this, but there was the point when, and I don't want to do any spoilers, but there's a point when somebody enters the subatomic realm. I'm not
the
quite
quantum
sure.
Realm.
Quantum realm, that's it. Just, and I do like the fact that he says, do you put quantum in front of everything? Is that, and they really do seem to do that. Where the screen goes black. And at that moment, I was taken out of the film. I realised I was in the cinema. I realised there were seats around me. There were other people around me. And it was quite interesting for me. I was like, oh, I'm watching a film. I'm sitting here in a cinema. And I was at that, the moment it went black, it was like I remembered where I was and I was kind of taken out of the film. And it took me a while to get back into the film. I don't know whether you had that moment where it's just me being weird.
Not really. I did enjoy the scenes in the quantum realm. I found them a tiny bit reminded me of Interstellar, you know, when he goes into strange dimensional space. And I always get quite freaked out by stuff like that, so I quite enjoyed it. But I wanted to mention something, if it's okay, just about the representation of a kind of a new female superhero, because I think they were quite self-conscious with what they were doing, trying to, you know, make, as you were saying earlier, Ant-Man and the Wasp, to give them that sort of dual responsibility for the kind of... And you're right, I do think she was underused in that respect, but I think there were certain scenes where they were trying to really kind of labour the point. So there's a moment when she walks into the hotel, you know, the hotel called We, and she faces off with that random villain who I felt was a bit of a pointless character, to be honest. But and all the colour is black and yellow. And I think they did that. I think there's moments like that where they're really trying. They're like, she's the Wasp. She's owning this scene. Here she comes. She's ready to sort of to be this female character we want her to be. But then they sort of forget about it again. And that was a bit disappointing for me, actually.
I think it was maybe kind of like something that was kind of tagged on afterwards, as opposed to, I think Captain Marvel will be kind of hopefully Marvel's Wonder Woman moment where they actually take a female superhero front and center and it's actually her story.
Yeah, I think so. I felt like it was kind of perhaps part of, they were trying to kind of capitalize a bit on the growing trend, which is a brilliant trend towards putting women more in the central kind of leading position in these kind of films. But yeah, that bit didn't quite work for me.
So yeah, Ant-Man and the Wasp, we've got mixed reviews, but I think we can mostly agree, apart from Laura, that it's a reasonably fun time at the movies. It opened last Friday and it's still showing at all three Cambridge cinemas. It's a certificate 12A. Written and directed by Brett Haley, Hearts Beat Loud is a love letter to the power of pop music, as well as both a portrayal of a father-daughter relationship and the panicked selfishness of a midlife crisis. Nick Offerman stars as Frank Fisher, a sad sack widower with only two loves, his record shop, which is going out of business, and his teenage daughter, who is moving away to medical school. His daughter, Sam, played by Kiersey Clemons, is also a songwriter, and during a late-night jam session, the two write a tune that becomes an accidental online hit. With Sam about to leave home, Frank wonders if the song's success could convince his daughter to stay.
We don't always get to do what we love, so we need to love what we do.
I never realized that was your secret.
Yep.
We've been trying to start a band with me since I was like 12.
We're not a band.
We're not a band. I like it.
I don't want to be in a band. And even if I did, I'm not going to be in one with my dad.
This is so good.
You wrote this.
Yeah. With my dad.
Sam talks to me now like she's the adult.
It's just her way of making it easier for you when they leave. We were
right at the wrong Maybe you could take a year off and we'll see what happens.
Are you suggesting that I don't go to college so that I can stay and be in a band with you?
You have the same thing that your mother had.
And if she were here right now...
No, you don't get to do that! Soon
I
won't be by
your side, give me... I've been here my whole life. I want something different. It's time to get away.
So, Niddy, the story of Heartbeat Loud is slightly fantastical in how a father and daughter can just unexpectedly achieve music success overnight. But is the central father-daughter relationship still believable and affecting despite this?
I think very much so, in terms of you have a widowed father who is going... And it's a coming-of-age story, but it's a coming-of-age story about him, not the daughter. The daughter is actually the sensible one. She actually has very much her head firmly on her shoulders. And, you know, it kind of flips around the whole, parent wanting their child to go to medical school and the child wants to be a rock star. And she's like, no, I want to go to medical school. And he's saying, no, be a rock star. So I think it does kind of flip it a little bit on that, on the head there. In terms of kind of the way it portrays it, I think what I really liked about the film, and I mean, it's got a great cast. You've got Nick Offerman and Parks and Recreation. You've got Ted Danson. You've got Toni Collette. I like the fact that the daughter wants to go to medical school and she has a creative mind. Not sure why I would like those two things to be a doctor and be creative, but that was really nice. And going back to kind of films that have come out earlier this year, I think it's continuing the trend from Love, Simon and Princess Sid of where somebody's sexual orientation is not the storyline. The fact that she happens to have a very sweet teen romance with another girl, it's not a thing. It's just the fact that she's having this sweet teen romance, which I really enjoyed. If I do have any criticisms of it, my main one would be that, you know, he is going through this midlife crisis and he's actually quite... not very nice to Toni Collette's character because she has the temerity to date somebody else. And, you know, they're not an exclusive relationship. They just have a couple of nice moments and he kind of blows it out to be this major romance and that somehow she should be completely dedicated to him, whereas she's just a woman who's just, you know, meeting people and dating, and he takes it as a real affront. And I think I would have preferred that had a bit more of a emphasis over the fact that he is not being a great person and that he's kind of taking that male ownership of, well, you know, I like you, and even though nothing actually has happened except for a couple of nice moments, how dare you go out and date somebody else? And, you know, he judges her for that and treats her quite badly as a result of that. And I don't think that's fully then acknowledged in the third act as to, you know, the fact that, you know, he doesn't own her.
Yeah, I just want to rewind a bit back to what you were saying about the fact that she is in a sort of a blossoming lesbian relationship with another girl who's played by Sasha Lane from American Honey. I found that to be like one of the least sensationalised portrayals of an LGBT character I've ever seen in cinema. And equally, like, both she and her girlfriend are mixed race and the film never mentions that. And I thought that was... And I thought it was refreshing to see that not be relevant to the plot at all. Is the fact that that's not a conflict a major positive, or is it sort of out of step with the realities of America at the minute?
I think on the whole, it's a major positive. I think, you know, as somebody who's not LGBT, I'm not in a position to be able to comment on kind of people's reality. I think it's an aspiration. It's an aspiration. And as I said, you know, it's a continuation from Love, Simon, where it's not an issue. Princess Sid, where it's not an issue. And I think it's a nice aspiration to have that it's not an issue. And in terms of a non-sensationalized kind of LGBT relationship, you know, Sasha Lane, you know, she has a much bigger role in the upcoming Miseducation of Cameron Post, where homosexuality is on the table, but not in the way that, you know, we have previously seen it portrayed in films. So, you know, I have seen it, so I'm not going to talk about it now because, you know, we've got that coming up soon in the next few weeks. But I think it's a major positive, and that's from a heterosexual point of view. And the fact that they're mixed race, you know, and the fact that it's not mentioned is great. There are issues within the black community about kind of the acceptable face of being black, which is kind of like the lighter mixed race blackness rather than, you know, fully. And again, I'm not in a position to really kind of have major commentary on that. But that is something that actually I think would be interesting to talk to other people about in terms of whether that's something that, you know, is this just then perpetuating the acceptability of that and not being fully dark-skinned as opposed to being kind of like light-skinned. Again, these are all small things which in a film that is working clearly very hard to be very inclusive and I think on the whole succeeds.
Okay, I'll just ask you one last quick question. It's on a much lighter note. I mean, it has one of the year's best soundtracks, I think. I absolutely loved the pop music in this. Would the film work equally as well if the songs that the father and daughter were, you know, writing and performing weren't as good?
So, I mean, I'm not a major music person, so the kind of music, it was like, oh yeah, it's okay. You know, I'd listen to this if it was on the radio. I do question having three songs back to back in the last act. It's like, okay, I didn't come to see a concert film. Like, I'm seeing a film and you're just having song after song. It is a great soundtrack, and I think if they had not put the effort in to have a good soundtrack, like, what is the point of this? I think it's a great advert for Spotify and iTunes. And, you know, Spotify is like, yes, you really can become a star by having a song by, you know, people that nobody have heard of. And it's like, that is really not what happens because everyone's putting their song on Spotify and only Taylor Swift is making money out of it.
Yeah, nobody's getting royalties from Spotify, so they're not getting rich off of having a hit song here.
And the idea that, you know, suddenly an A&R man is going to turn up at your door saying, I want to sign you based upon one song out of 10 million on Spotify. You know, what you said in your intro about it being fantastical, and that was kind of what's like, really, really, is this really how it happens? And so I just, you know, I feel sorry for any aspiring musician who thinks, yes, this can really happen. It's like, it doesn't happen like that.
I mean, if you look past how fantastical it is, Hearts Beat Loud is just absolutely lovely. And it's open last week and it's still showing at the Arts Picture House, and yeah, check it out. It's a lovely little film for this time of summer. It's certificate 12A. On the last Bums on Seats, we spoke to Selena Robertson of feminist and queer film collective Club de Femme about the amazing 60-year career of French director Agnès Varda. Selena talked about Varda's political activism and why her extraordinarily inventive and humanistic films are not better known. You can still listen to that interview on our last podcast. Eight of Agnès Varda's classic films are now touring UK cinemas as part of Gleaning Truths, a season programmed by Curzon Cinemas and made possible with the support of the BFI, which is awarding funds from the National Lottery. All of these eight films, plus Varda's new documentary, Faces Places, are screening at the Arts Picture House between now and October, so it seemed wise to run a second, more detailed feature on the great director. This time we spoke to Aga Baranowska, events programmer for the BFI. Speaking to Bums on Seats host Toby Miller, Aga explained a little about Agnès Varda's wonderful versatility as a filmmaker.
I wondered if you'd be able to tell me a little bit about Agnès Varda's background before her first film. The, the French New Wave, which came a little bit later, that was famous because they were all cine literate. They were critics and then they became directors. But I believe Varda mentioned that she'd seen very few films before she embarked on her career as a director.
Yes, that's true. She has mentioned a number of times that she had only seen a few films before making her first film, La Pointe Courage, in 1954. So before making films, she was interested in photography and art history, and she in fact studied photography and art history and started working as a photographer before making her first film. Going back to the French New Wave, I think she has a loose affinity with the French New Wave. There was another movement that kind of started around the same time, that's Left Bank Group, with such filmmakers as Chris Marker, Jacques Demy, Alain Resnais, and Agnès Varda loosely. And they were more experimental, they were more left-wing. Something else that it would be important to mention is that even though Agnès Varda was making films while the French New Wave was happening and while the left bank filmmakers were making their films, I think you can see that her style and her approach to cinema is very unique and distinctive.
The Gleaning Truths season of Agnès Varda's work. It's 8 films, 9 films with faces, places long. Were those films chosen to illustrate the wide variety of her career as a director?
Yes, it does show a wide variety in Varda's work. Her first 2 films are included, so La Pointe Courte and Cleo from 5 to 7. Then the following 3 films, so Le Bonheur, One Sings, the Other Doesn't, and A Vagabond, are 3 films where she very much focuses on female experience with 3 very different female characters, all very compelling, all very unique, but the focus is very much on the female experience.
C'est donc si grave?
J'ai vu le cancer, elle est perdue.
Then they've also included Jacques Denant, which is a film about her late husband, Jacques Demy, who himself was a filmmaker. And it's a lovely feature film that also includes documentary footage about his early years.
C'est comme un mouvement continu. Si par exemple on filme mon bras, tac 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 tac, ça donne un mouvement continu.
Ah, ça va pas du tout. C'est flou, c'est bougé. Ça va vraiment pas.
And the last 2 films in the touring program in the season are The Gleaners and I and The Beaches of Agnes. So 2 documentaries that she looks back at what it means to be an artist, what it means to be creative. And in the case of The Beaches of Agnes, she looks at her own life. So I think it does show a wide range of her filmmaking approaches, her filmmaking style and interests. In terms of themes.
One film in Gleaning Truths is her 1977 drama One Sings, the Other Doesn't, which is about activism on abortion rights. I saw it for the first time only last month and I was blown away. I thought it's the complexities of the female characters and how she depicted female friendships. That was just amazing. Was it a particularly personal film for her?
Yes, it was a very personal project for Varda. She was involved in the abortion rights movement and more broadly in the women's liberation movement in France in the 70s. The film is very personal, and I think that that's one of the reasons why the film is so relevant and has great resonance with today. You can really feel and see the commitment to the issue and to the subject matter. And that's why the film is still so relevant so many years after the release and had a premiere of a restored version of the film in Cannes this year.
Of the 8 films you have screening, 2 in particular, The Beaches of Agnes and The Gleaners and I, show Agnès Varda's deep interest in ordinary people. The whole subject matter of Gleaners and I, but in The Beaches of Agnes, the way she talks about her neighbours, I think is remarkable. Is it fair to say that she presents the lives of others without the usual pathos that cinema can fall into. She's not examining them. She's looking at them at the same level as herself, if that makes sense.
So yes, I think it's a very fair assessment that she is very much interested in ordinary people, people on the margins. You can see that in her first film, La Pointe Courte, which has two stories, one of a married couple going through difficulties and another one of fishermen in a small fishing village. And we really get to know them, their problems, their what makes them laugh, what makes them happy, basically, we get to know their everyday lives. And that is something that Varda is very much interested throughout her career, and very much until her last film, which will be released in cinemas in September, Faces Places, where she travels across rural France with photographer JR and meets everyday people, talks to them about their lives and celebrates their everyday lives with pieces of art. So she takes, together with JR, they take photos of them and put them up on walls, in public spaces.
Le truc rigolo, c'est qu'on va faire un film ensemble.
Bah ouais, c'est ça le point de départ.
Mais qu'est-ce qu'on va faire?
Mais on va faire des images ensemble, mais autrement.
Between her first two films, Agnès Varda traveled through China as a photographer, and later she visited Cuba, and when she was in America, she explored numerous subcultures. Would you say this insatiable curiosity is one of her main strengths as a filmmaker? Because for other directors, those might just have been detours, but they seem crucial to Varda's later work.
Absolutely. She is, in my mind, very much a very curious filmmaker, but not only a filmmaker, but artist more broadly. So she, as I mentioned before, photography and painting are big influences for her. But also she also experiments very much in terms of the structure of her films. One example that I can briefly talk about is Vagabond, which is part of the Gleaning Truth season, which starts with a big revelation at the beginning and then kind of shows the life of the main protagonist, Mona, what led her to that big moment in her life. So definitely, I think curiosity and a need or a willingness to what Varda herself called to invent or reinvent the cinema, looking for new ways of approaching cinematic form.
Bonne route, ma fille. La porte sera toujours ouverte.
Merci.
Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Many thanks to Aga Baranowska for that interview, and to Elizabeth Parkinson at the BFI for setting up the phone call. And once again, we're grateful to Rebecca Del Tufo of Saffron Screen for her assistance in getting the ball rolling. The next screening in the Gleaning Truth season is coming this Thursday, August the 16th, with a chance to see Agnès Varda's Le Bonheur. Then, on August 23rd, you can catch the superb One Sings, The Other Doesn't.
If you like books, writing, fiction, non-fiction, poetry, drama, and chat with authors from Cambridge and beyond, then save the page to bookmark every other Saturday at 1 p.m. with me, Lee Chambers, on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city.
Cambridge has a vibrant food and drink scene. On Flavour, we talk with a wide range of food and drink producers. We visit cafes, restaurants, pubs and independent food stores. We find out what's new and what's good. We review the food items in the papers. If it's about food and drink, if it's local and good, it's on Flavour. Alternate Saturdays, 12 till 1, on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city.
Across the city and South Cambridgeshire.
On FM, digital and your mobile.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
You are listening to Bums on Seats with me, Alistair Ryder, and reviewers Rosie Aplin, Laura Poole, Eleanor Franks and Nidhi Gupta. Still to come on today's show, we'll take a look at the reissued Heathers, but first, we head to 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Jonas, this happened this morning.
It's crushing me!
They may have encountered the same species you did down there.
It's a shark.
It's a megalodon.
fossil.
Thought to have been extinct over 2 million years.
Wrong.
A lot of people are gonna die if we don't find it and kill it.
It's a great day to go fishing.
He's kidding, right?
You saying we opened up a superhighway for giant sharks?
No, just a meg. I'm gonna make this thing bleed.
In a summer of sequels and superheroes, The Meg, a new film about a giant prehistoric shark terrorizing the South China Seas, counts as a rare original. The film opens in a futuristic underwater research facility, where scientists investigating the deepest trenches of the Pacific Ocean accidentally stumble upon a hidden world of aquatic mysteries. Upon investigating this new world, all communication is lost with one of their submersibles. The authorities turn for help to Jonas Taylor, a brilliant but disgraced naval diver, played by Jason Statham. But Jonas has been that deep once before, and he suspects that science has woken a megalodon, an ancient giant shark thought to be extinct. Laura, I know that you liked the last Jurassic World movie, so I'm calling you our resident monster movie lover, so I'm going to you first. The Meg was originally going to head to the screen in the late 90s, amidst all of the different Jurassic Park rip-offs. Now it's arriving after the billion-dollar success of Jurassic World. Does it feel original, or does it just feel like it's just cashing in on that formula but with a shark?
I think it's a real shame it wasn't released in the 90s because I spent most of this film just laughing at it. I mean, you can't expect that you're seeing anything serious or new or refreshing, but it's hilarious. I mean, it is literally Jason Statham running around with his top off quite a lot, saving the female characters constantly while trying to kill a living fossil shark. If it had been the 90s, I think it would have had more of its place. But as I was watching it, I just kept thinking of, like, Deep Blue Sea, and it felt a bit of a rip-off of that to me. And I even felt like I could match up the characters from each film. And why was Ruby Rose in there? Other to say Ruby Rose was in it. I think all she did was fall in the ocean and said about two lines. And Jason Statham's accent, Rosie.
Oh, well, it was very interesting. It was quite a movable feast. This is the first Jason Statham film I've ever seen, and it did take me a little while to acclimatise to his acting range. I have to admit, I was genuinely laughing out loud at first, and I felt like one of those really annoying people in cinema because I was thinking other people are probably enjoying this, and I'm just laughing derisively. But it was genuinely remarkable. The dialogue was so cheesy. I couldn't believe it. I mean, there's one bit where somebody says, "Well, how many leagues deep can we go?" And he says, "Okay, at 5 leagues, there's 8 leagues. After 11, it's just numbers." And it's just full of things like that. And you're like, what does that mean? Are you saying 11 is bad? Is 11 the cutoff point? But nobody questions anything. It's just it's just cheesy line after cheesy line. And then, like, I mean, I did enjoy it because I've never seen a film like this before. I was trying to expand my sort of repertoire of films that I go and see, and I would never choose to see a film like this. And it was, like, cracking fun, but awful. I mean, just remarkably bad, really, from start to finish.
Nidhi's got a question.
Yes, as somebody who will not see this film, but I have to admit I've seen Sharknado, 1 and 2, not any of the other ones. How does it rate compared to Sharknado?
Oh, no, Sharknado is a whole class of its own. We can't compare anything to Sharknado.
Sharknado was a Citizen Kane of this type of movie.
But, I mean, it just was hilarious. I mean, Jason Statham, at least he got to use his diving skills that he learned from when he was an Olympic diver at 18.
Yeah.
A little fun Jason Statham fact
there.
That's
a good fact. I think the best parts of the film are when, so they finish the exposition at the beginning, they finish doing all their character setting, I'm this guy, I'm the doctor, you know, all this kind of thing. Once it gets into the action bit, it's actually quite good in terms of, you know, tension, and you are thinking, oh no, are all these people going to die because of this enormous, massive shark thing? And, you know, that's quite scary, but for the most part, it is terrible. It's a terrible film. It's hard to say. I don't know.
Because I think Jason Statham's acting is the same in everything. He's just Jason Statham. It's it's one-dimensional. And I could not figure out if this film was supposed to be serious.
It felt like
or
a spoof.
Silly.
It did feel like a spoof.
I would say, in defence of Jason Statham, I think he has his tongue further in cheek than most action stars. If you watch,
definitely.
If you watch, like, Spy, where he basically sends up his own persona, or
that's
even
the
Crank films, like, he gets the silliness of what he's doing. I don't think he's ever trying to be a serious actor. So that's my defence of him. He knows what he's there for.
I think that's a good point. And if it is that, then it's doing it quite well, I think.
I will say that I'm not sure who it was, but the girl who played the little girl, the scientist's daughter, she was really good
in
it.
She was probably the best actor in this film, I would say.
Yeah, the 8-year-old girl out-acted all the adults in this film.
Yes, and I'm now going to try and pronounce the name of this actress. She is called Shia Sophia Kai.
I'm sure that's exactly how you pronounce it.
That's exactly how it is. Nobody is going to write in and complain about my pronunciation. What I do want to ask, though, is the fact that this film was originally shot as a sort of 15-rated, very violent film that was then edited down by the studio to be family-friendly.
No.
Could you tell?
No, I had no idea at that.
It was apparently, like, very bloody with lots of sharks killing people.
Because it wasn't.
No, there's not that much. There's a bit where Rainn Wilson's character... Oh, there's a bloody scene with him in which I won't... That's a bit of a spoiler, isn't it? But, you know, when he's got his hand on the side of the boat...
But there isn't a lot of blood and gore.
Hardly any.
I think there was a scene with a beach where it was known to be the most packed beach in South Asia, South China region, and the megalodon heads for it. And you see it's just literally cram-packed of all these tourists swimming in their little... rubber ducks. And the megalodon's swimming under them and starts to attack. And I think if they wanted it to be a 15, that scene could have been amazingly gory.
There could have been loads of dismembering, but there was hardly any.
But you didn't see anything.
None,
you saw it
actually.
Literally bump into a few floating things in the sea.
Yeah.
And there was a very amusing scene with a little chubby boy who kept eating his ice lolly throughout the shark attack. But
the kind of thing that makes you think maybe it is just a big spoof and it's meant to be.
Nobody was killed. There were all these people in the scene. No one was shown being ripped apart. So I don't understand how it was originally intended to be a 15 gore fest.
You sound disappointed.
Well, I'm a bit sick in the head like that.
You want more dismembering. That's what you just said.
I wanted dismembering. I want the shark eating everyone and seeing limbs floating.
Yeah,
and we didn't get that.
No.
So, yeah, if you do want a shark film with very little dismembering, the Meg opened yesterday and is now devouring the competition at both Cambridge Multiplex cinemas. It is a certificate 12A. Our last film of the show is the re-release of Heathers, the seminal black comedy that back in 1988 ended the teen movie boom with a bang. Winona Ryder stars as Veronica Sawyer, who is very nearly the happiest girl at Westerberg High. She swans about with the Heathers, a clique of beautiful girls who have the run of the school and the admiration of almost all the students. But that popularity is enforced with bullying, and Veronica knows the cruelty is going too far. Then, onto the scene arrives J.D. Dean, played by Christian Slater. Enigmatic, cunning and possessing a devilish charm, Dean is a rebel with an urge to burn down the whole rotten system.
You wanted to be a member of the most powerful clique in school.
Dear Diary, Heather said she teaches people real life.
You were nothing before you met me. You were a Girl Scout cookie.
You a Heather?
No, I'm a Veronica. I don't really like my friends.
I don't really like your friends either.
There are people I work with, and our job is being popular.
Maybe it's time to take a vacation.
I just killed my best friend.
And your worst enemy.
Same difference.
My teen angst has a body count. This is a tragic thing.
Hallelujah.
You were out of control.
Take out her tonsils? Ha! Is this as good for you as it is for me?
Life can suck!
Rosie, Heathers was a jet black comic antidote to the John Hughes movies that were popular in the 80s. Is it still like the shocking comedy, or has the past 30 years mellowed its anger?
Oh, it's still absolutely toxic. It's, I was really surprised because I hadn't seen it originally, unlike a lot of people. And I didn't know what to expect. I was kind of thinking, oh, it's going to be about a group of bullies and how the bullied Winona Ryder character stands up against them with the help of gallant Christian Slater. How wrong I was. I mean, it was so not that film at all. And it was brilliant. It was so refreshing, full of dark humour, a real comment on sort of capitalism and, you know, set in the Reagan era. And you can really see that absolutely running through the whole thing. It's very dark. Almost none of the characters are likable, I don't think, even Winona and certainly not Christian Slater. They're all quite selfish, really, which just makes it massively refreshing and definitely, as you said, an antidote to those John Hughes films. It's not what I was expecting at all, and I loved it.
But you know who has an opposite opinion in terms of things being likable? It's Niddy. So, Niddy, can you tell us what you think of the Winona Ryder and Christian Slater characters?
Oh, I love them so much. So, I remember watching this during my Christian Slater phase. I went back to kind of women of a certain age, we have a Christian Slater phase. And I think I was about 16 or so when I went back to kind of this. I think this is breakout film. And I remember at the time kind of just loving this really toxic relationship between Jason Dean, JD, and Veronica Sawyer. And I thought, I haven't seen it since then. And I thought, watching it this week, I thought, okay, when I'm going, I remembered it. And I was like, well, I'm going to not like this relationship. It's very toxic. I'm going to, you know, actually have a very different view of the ending. I have a memory of reading how the original ending was that they, I mean, I hope I'm not doing any spoilers, that they do actually succeed in their original plan, but the studio made Lehman change it. And I watched it again this last week and, you know, absolutely, it's so brilliantly acerbic and it's such an amazing satire. And I think, you know, growing up with things like Clueless, you know, those films would never have existed without Heathers. I actually wanted them to succeed. I wanted JD and Veronica to go out in a blaze of glory, quite literally. I wanted them to continue and actually get rid of this entire school, which, you know, this film was made before Columbine, you know, I think if they had gone with the original plan, you would never see it again because, of course, all the horrific school shootings in America. But I think because it's a satire and all the characters in the school, especially the adults, you know, all these bad absent parentism, you know, and the teachers just being appalling as the kids, because they're such kind of broad brushstroked characters, it was like, yeah, get rid of them. A dark, dark moment for me. I'm sorry.
So, Eleanor, I was just wondering, did you see this film as a teen? And if so, like, how does it stand up for you when watching as an adult?
Now, I didn't see it the first time round. And all I remember of Heathers is having line after line quoted at me at school. I actually thought seeing it that I felt it had dated a bit, that it was a little bit old. And there's some very good things like, you know, you can endlessly quote it. It captures teenage language beautifully, like Heathers keeps saying. It'll be very, and that's great. But, I just felt it. I'd be interested to know what teenagers seeing it nowadays really thought of it.
Okay, and Laura, I'm going to ask the same question to you. Do you have an experience of watching this as a teenager and how, watching it now, how does it hold up?
Well, I think I was far too young when I first saw it because I have an older sister. So I was about 7 or 8 and was brought up watching this film. Don't think my parents knew I saw it. So I just have, my memories of it were totally different to when I then rewatched it for this show. And I always remember loving it. And I remembered it was obviously about the two main characters basically killing the popular children. And it's only when I rewatched it now, I realised how dark it is. I mean, funny at the same time, but being younger, I did not pick up on any of that. And I re-loved it again. I so fell back in love with it. There's just so many good lines, and half of them we can't say on air because they are just far too rude. But it's just brilliant, and it so does go in for the high school clique. I mean, you can, obviously it takes it way above, but you can imagine people being at school and hating the popular girls and the groups.
And I think the first Heather, and we're not too many spoilers, she dies because it happens in the first act. Looking back at it and rewatching it, I actually felt really sorry for her, because what is consistent in her character is this desperation to please and to be seen to be a certain type of person. And she does certain things which even she hates herself for doing, at this kind of Remington party at the university. And I remember my university days, and getting into a university party was like,
literally nothing special. You know, and so I actually felt really sorry for her as a character, because clearly she's somebody who lacks self-confidence and has no self-esteem. And so it's built up this persona of Heather, you know, the popular girl. And I think in terms of the datedness, yes, the kind of the gay storyline with mineral water, which I think has really dated, and also kind of, but I could easily see, as you were saying, in terms of it rooted in reality, in terms of I could see how, well, instead of it being cable news where all these people go to, be all over the internet, you know, there's not a huge leap that needs to be made in your head to go, well, actually, this could happen to, you know, in terms of the way it can be relevant today, just adding a few more extra smartphones, essentially.
I think it's interesting watching it now in terms of where we are with American politics now, and because of where it was set at the time, and that whole kind of corporate greed is good, everything is very, and there's this running theme which is really on the nose with which is this kind of, the colour scheme is red and blue, and so you see the red scrunchies, it's really the point is really hammered home. And it's interesting because the way the first Heather is killed is with this sort of blue poison. And it's hard not to detach it from the kind of the colours of the political parties, and kind of, I think red is sort of representative of power and lust, but maybe also kind of belonging to this sort of powerful elite. And as you can see, Winona Ryder's character is constantly wearing blue as this sort of antithesis to this red, this pervasive red that carries on throughout the film. So that was really interesting.
Yeah, I'm just going to pick up on what Nidhi touched on in terms of some of the jokes might be appearing outdated now, such as the gay joke with a mineral water. I just want to say, are there certain topics of jokes that just feel completely outdated now, or does it still just hold up as a sort of a document of that time?
I think actually it's a bit different to that, because I mean, the way that it's presented, we're in kind of a Midwestern, if I'm not wrong, you know, quite conservative area, you know, and you know, I would argue that being gay is still not acceptably open in some of those communities. And so actually, I don't think it's completely separated from reality 30 years later. And that, OK, whilst, you know, having, you know, mineral water is no longer a badge. I didn't even know it was a badge. Even
I was not aware of that.
But I remember watching at the time going, where has this come from? You know, when I watched it kind of in the mid-90s, and I still think, like, where did this come from? But the line where if you're not having a brewski, you might as well be wearing a dress, you know, that kind of sentiment, I think, still is valid today in kind of certain parts of America. So I think to some extent it's dated from the point of view of how they represent the homophobia, but I don't think the homophobia itself is dated at all.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, some things also never date, like the whole popularity storyline of, you know, it's all about who's popular at school, what do they have to do, how do they treat other people. That never dates, you know, that didn't date, I don't think.
Yeah, so what I'm now going to ask you all, and this is a question to everybody, I mean, this is one of the defining teen movies of the 80s. I mean, would you call it the best teen movie of the 80s? And if not, what would your favourite 80s teen movie be?
What a question.
I'm going to go on a limb and actually say, for me, it is, because it's got such a dark heart, in that I do love my John Hughes movies, you know, Pretty in Pink and all those films, but I think this was such the, as you said in the beginning, this is an antidote to all those films. And you can notice all the big films after it in the last 30 years that have focused on high school and teenagers. Yes, there are still lots of sweet high school teen romance type films, whatever, but the ones that have really made a difference in terms of made box office success, like Clueless, like Mean Girls, they've got a bit of a dark heart to them. But that's me.
I have to go for two classic 80s for me. This is one of them. And then, you know, I think I was born the year it came out, but it has to be Dirty Dancing as my other 80s classic.
No,
sorry,
no.
Everybody.
Oh, no.
But brought up watching it. Love it.
Oh, I wasn't watching films in the 80s, so I'm going to pass on this question.
I've got to say, this is taking it back to our first film, but I was completely obsessed with Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Yes!
And just to go back to Ant-Man, I was so happy to see the big ant in this film because it just reminded me of Auntie. And I was like, oh, look, he's alive. and they were teenagers, I think, in that film. So that's slightly...
I mean, I was like, you know, like 6 or 7 in the 80s. So I'm talking about 80s films that I saw in the 90s. Oh, yeah.
Born late 80s. Yeah. So I watched them a lot later.
But I wish I'd seen this when I was younger because I think it's a really important film to watch. It's really about sort of, I mean, it's got so many points to make, even though it's not very subtle about them. It's an important film, I think.
And then I thought another interesting bit on it was there was actually quite a big thing pushed on almost sexual assault of the girls. Mm. Obviously, the first Heather in the party, we kind of do see, to say it politely, but her head's being pushed somewhere. And at the end of it, she kind of spits water at herself in the mirror. She hates herself. She feels like she's been forced. Mm. And then in another scene, the second Heather is on a date. And they clearly show, and they don't make a big deal of it at all, but they clearly show she's kind of fighting her date off.
But do you think they should have made a big deal out of it? Do you think, because they're in two scenes later, Chris says, well, all these jocks have to offer now are date rapes and AIDS jokes. So, you know, there is a little bit of an acknowledgement, but the character of Heather, who is sexually assaulted, she doesn't acknowledge that she's been assaulted.
No, exactly. I think it worked how they did it.
You think so? Okay.
And I do. And then the second Heather, who was assaulted, she even rings a line at one point and says, the last guy that I slept with killed himself. And she saw it as consensual, but they didn't show it as consensual at all. And I found that a really interesting way that they did that. And
well, so the actress, I read an interview with the actress who played the second Heather, or third Heather, whichever way we're talking about. And she says it wasn't intended that way. It was literally just a funny scene.
That's the thing. I feel like it was definitely played for laughs. Mm.
Okay, so that was a very light note to end it on, but Heathers has just been re-released. It's screening again at the Arts Picture House this Monday, August the 13th at 9 p.m. So if you've never seen it before and you want to check it out, make sure you head down. But that is all we have time for on today's show. As ever, the past hour will be repeated tomorrow at 2 p.m. Then our podcast will be released on Monday. That can be downloaded or streamed from our page on the Cambridge 105 website. We're also to be found on iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show and leave a review if you so choose. We're back in a fortnight's time on Saturday, August the 25th. On that show should be a review of the much-anticipated Black Klansman, Spike Lee's furious comedy drama about the Ku Klux Klan and the persistence of racism in America. Also released is Disney's Christopher Robin, plus there's Emma Thompson and Stanley the Tooch Toochie in the Ian McEwan-written drama The Children Act. A reminder that Apostasy, which the team on the last episode loved, is a... still streaming at the Arts Picture House, so make sure to check that out. But please stay tuned for Bookmark. But from everybody here on Bums on Seat, goodbye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.